morning again. Was anybody else working out better solutions to that cheese problem, mouse problem, lion problem? There's so many ways. You just don't keep going back to the same wise men time after time. But we're going way, way back. We're going back to the Epic of Gilgamesh. Last week we heard about the great Gilgamesh, fifth king of the seventh dynasty of the rulers of Uruk in ancient Mesopotamia, the largest city in the world at that time. But instead of the real historical king, we met the Gilgamesh of legend, the first international superhero whose story has been written in every language from that part of the world. Who can compare with him in kingliness? Who can say, like Gilgamesh, I am king? Whose name from the day of his birth was called Gilgamesh? Two-thirds of him is God. One-third of him is human. We also met his sidekick, Enkidu, the wild and hairy man, who appears at first as a rival to Gilgamesh, but becomes his dearest friend when the two of them face Humbaba, the great monster who guards the cedar forests of Lebanon from all intruders. Humbaba's roar is a flood, his mouth is fire, his breath is death. He can hear 100 leagues away any rustling in his forest. Who would go there? The gods assigned him as a terror to human beings, and whoever goes into his forest, paralysis will strike. Well, Gilgamesh and Enkidu overcome that paralysis, that sense of terror, and then they overcome the monster himself. But even as they stand by a river, washing off the blood and the gore of battle, a new danger appears in seductive form. Looking down from heaven, the goddess Ishtar sees Gilgamesh and falls for him head over heels. She purrs, "Come along, Gilgamesh. Be you my husband. To me grant your lusciousness. Be you my husband and I'll be your wife." A goddess making an offer nobody could possibly refuse, right? We'll see in a moment, after we visit those heavenly realms ourselves on the river of Deborah's music. It sounds like a journey. You know, you have to reset. You take some of your journey, some of your steps, and reset. And you finally end up in that deep place at the end. Thank you. That was beautiful. Come along, Gilgamesh. Be you my husband. To me grant your lusciousness. Be you my husband, and I will be your wife. Ishtar promises to make Gilgamesh king of the kings beyond Uruk, to give him fabulous horses and chariots, and to bear him children that will be completely divine. Forget that one-third human stuff. This sounds like an offer no one could refuse, but that's just what Gilgamesh does. He recites the fate of Ishtar's other lovers and husbands. One had the form of a bird. She broke his wing and left him to mourn over it. One was a shepherd whom she turned into a wolf. Another was a gardener changed into a mole and sent to live underground and ruin the garden. Thanks, says Gilgamesh, but no thanks, darling. Ishtar flies into a rage. She's never been refused before, so now she demands that the other gods give her the bull of heaven to send against Gilgamesh and Enkidu. They hesitate, pointing out that Gilgamesh has good reason to reject her proposal. After all, she has proved to be mighty hard to live with, high maintenance, to say the least. But Ishtar swears that if they refuse, she'll raise the dead. They'll swarm over the human race and devour everything. It's the first zombie apocalypse in recorded media history, and it even scares the gods. They relent and give her the bull of heaven to use as she will. She leads it down to the gates of Uruk and then sets it loose against the city. So what is the bull of heaven? If you're familiar with monster stories and monster movies, you know that after the first monster, which is usually bad enough, comes the really, really big one. First comes Grendel, then Grendel's mother. First, the little dinosaurs, but they're so cute, and then the T-Rex. A problem with mice becomes more like a problem with elephants. The struggle with Humbaba was just a warm-up for meeting the really big monster. In this case, the bull of heaven. You could probably fit Humbaba into its ear or its nose. It snorts once, and 100 soldiers fall into the pit that opens. It snorts again, and 200 men fall into the pit. It's the third snort opens up a crack that swallows Enkidu up to his waist. He grabs the bull by the horns, literally, and calls out to Gilgamesh. Spies a soft spot on the nape of the neck. He tells his buddy, strike with his sword. There, hit it there. Whack, thwack. The monster is brought down and its horns are hung on the palace of Uruk. How many times have we witnessed this kind of scene in science fiction, fantasy, and other adventure stories? It's a very, very ancient pattern, repeating itself over centuries and millennia. Two buddies overcome their initial rivalry to prevail over challenge after challenge and win great glory together. But then comes something that can't be overpowered or finessed away. Ishtar, angrier than ever, persuades the gods who had helped these heroes that now they're getting too sure of themselves. After a heated debate, the majority of gods decide that one of the two must die. Death was always a possibility in the first two battles, but now it becomes something real. Enkidu perceives in a dream that so soon after grabbing the bull by the horns, he's now the one with the bullseye on his back. Soon he falls ill and has a vision of death that also gives us a glimpse of the Sumerian view of the afterlife. He sees himself transformed into a bird, drifting down to a house where those who enter do not come out, along the road of no return, to the house where those who dwell do without light, where dirt is their drink, their food is of clay, where, like a bird, they wear garments of feathers. It's a dim, grim place, not truly dark, darkness might be a comfort, but instead it's a sort of a half-light, just enough for the dead to perceive their condition and to see that it does not change. Like gray, flightless birds, they mostly just sit or stand in silence, row after row after row of them. On entering the house of dust, everywhere I looked, there were royal crowns gathered in heaps from the bearers of the crowns, who in the past had ruled the land. These kings and queens are now in service to the lords of the underworld, though there is little for them to actually do. Cities like Uruk and the lands around them were among the first true states to emerge in human history. The state was an astounding innovation that made things like temples and monuments and libraries possible, and riches, at least for some, that could not have been imagined before. It's no surprise that people began to imagine the gods existing in a state grander than any state on earth. Nor should it surprise us that they would conceive of death as being a kind of state as well. And such ideas remain with us today. Do you imagine that there is a state of death, something like the state of Uruk or the state of Oregon? I wonder. Although it's hard to believe that it will ever happen to me, I'm beginning to accept that someday I will die. Sooner or later, dying must happen. But will I then be relocated to some state called death? I myself, or in the form of a flightless bird? I imagine unhappy kiwis there in the darkness. Or is death a construct in the imagination of those who remain alive? An empty place felt by those who love me. A place that's now filled with my absence. Is death what others experience on my behalf? Construct or real, Enkidu describes this state to his friend just before he dies, and Gilgamesh is undone. He thinks that Enkidu will come back if he weeps long enough. He clings to the dead body for 7 days until it begins to visibly decompose. Only then will he allow it to be buried. He dresses in skins and lets his hair grow long like his friends had been, and he weeps bitter tears. But soon, the king's thoughts turn back to himself. Now that he's alone again, just one man without a second, Butch Cassidy without Sundance, he starts to put two and two together. I am going to die. Am I not like Enkidu? Deep sadness penetrates my core. I fear death. He must find a way to live forever. But who can tell him how? He's heard of one man, Utnapishtim. Utnapishtim is like the Sumerian Noah. He survived a great flood sent by the gods in ages past by building a huge reed boat and stocking it with animals of every species, pairs of them. Utnapishtim must be for that service, he and his wife both were given eternal life. Saved all the beasties, you get to live, right? Forever. Utnapishtim, therefore, must be an extraordinary person, possessing great secrets that he might share if only Gilgamesh can find him. He begins this torturous journey that takes him many miles over land and underground. The darkness there, deep darkness, does not trouble him. It's the half-light in the house of dust that he fears. To spend an eternity aware of himself, but dead. He encounters a number of persons on his journey, both human and divine. Everyone has heard of him, naturally. He's famous. And they all ask the same question. If you are Gilgamesh, who destroyed Humbaba, who grappled with the bull that came down from heaven and killed him, why are your cheeks emaciated, your expression desolate? Why is your heart so wretched, your features so haggard? Why is there such sadness deep within you? Look at you. Look at you with your beauty, your power, your fame and fortune and all that you've accomplished. You're awesome. How can you, of all people, feel such despair? How can you, Kurt Cobain, Sylvia Plath, Kate Spade, Anthony Bourdain, Ernest Hemingway, and so many others? How many times have we asked this when some famous person crashes and burns, whether they survive or not? A few years back, you may have heard that during the height of our global economic crisis, a German billionaire threw himself under a train after he had fallen from being the 44th richest man in the world down to number 94. We ask, what do you have to feel so bad about? How many times have we asked this of others, including our not-so-famous friends or our not-so-famous selves? Why such sadness deep within you? How do you answer this question? Gilgamesh answers that question with his own. Why should not my cheeks be emaciated? Should my heart not be wretched, my features not haggard? Should there not be sadness deep within me? My friend, whom I love deeply, who went through every hardship with me, Enkidu, the fate of mankind has overtaken him. My friend, whom I love, has turned to clay. Am I not like him? Will I lie down never to get up again? Our friends and loved ones stand between us and death. When they are gone, we feel exposed to the fate of humankind, the fate of all living creatures, to lie down at last and not get up again. We who offer support try to fill the empty spaces with our words. Beyond the words, we try to fill them with ourselves. We do the best we can, but it will never be enough. There's a journey to be taken that no one else can take for us. Gilgamesh continues on to the shores of the great sea, where he asks a ferryman to take him in his boat to find Utnapishtim. There are more struggles and encounters that follow that I don't have time for today, but at last Gilgamesh reaches the other side of the water. He gets there. And there we find that even Utnapishtim, the Sumerian Noah, has heard of Gilgamesh and now, like everyone else, asks him why he looks so troubled. Gilgamesh pours out his litany of sadness and loss to the immortal man, expecting that now, at last, he will get some answers, a solution to the problem. How shall I find the life for which I am searching? To his surprise, if maybe not to ours, Utnapishtim replies, there is no permanence. Do we build a house to stand forever? Do we seal a contract to hold for all time? From the days of old, there is no permanence. No permanence, no guarantees, no warranties for a human being. Gilgamesh complains, I look at you now, Utnapishtim, and your appearance is no different from mine. There's nothing strange in your features. I thought I'd find you like a hero prepared for battle, but you lie here taking your ease on your back. How extraordinary that the only man to achieve immortality, the oldest person in the world, turns out to be so ordinary. He has no special powers or ability. He has no edge, because only mortality can give you that. He's a bore. Lindapishtim just lies back, taking it easy. He seems to have no special wisdom. What does he tell Gilgamesh that you couldn't, Emma? Barbara? Linda? Hank? What? Anybody could tell him that. There is no permanence. Nothing lasts forever. Gilgamesh crossed the world and the ocean to hear this? Well, yes, he did. There's something different about hearing it after coming so far. Hearing it from the oldest human voice there is, just as it's something special for us to hear it coming from what is perhaps the oldest long story known to humankind. In the long millennia since it was first written down, we've learned a great deal about chemistry, astronomy, electricity, agriculture, disease, and medicine, but about ourselves, our destinies, how to live when we know that someday we must all die, how much more do we really know even after 5,000 years? So should we give up trying? Gilgamesh, I'm happy to tell you, is not quite ready to give up. He asks if there's anything else he might do in order to live forever. And finally, if only to please him, Utnapishtim says, yes, there's a certain plant. Ooh, a plant, a pill, an herbal supplement. Just what we all want to hear. Right? If nothing prevents dying, I'm going to go get me some nothing. It grows only in the deepest part of the sea, and it has thorns that will wound your hands, but it will restore a person's lost youth if you can get a hold of it. Gilgamesh sets sail with the ferryman, ties stones to the bottoms of his feet, and then when they reach the middle of the water, down he goes. Sees the plant, grabs it in spite of the pain from the thorns, cuts loose his diving stones, and is washed up on shore. Soon the ferryman joins him. And Gilgamesh says, come on, let's hurry to my city. I'm going to give this stuff to my people so they can be young again. It's good to hear the king is no longer thinking only of himself. Huh? Something's changed. The journey's not been for nothing. Or has it? On the way to the city, Gilgamesh pauses to wash in a deep pool of clear water, leaving the plant on one side. A serpent that's been sleeping at the bottom of the pool sees the plant, snatches it away, off it goes, slithering through underground channels to return the plant to the ocean floor, and I suspect Ishtar's hand in this. Gilgamesh is right back where he started from, like the king in our children's story. He sits down to cry for a while, and then asks the ferryman Ushanabi if perhaps he has some advice. Ushanabi has little to say. He just stays by his companion's side. And sometimes that may be the best that anyone can do. At last, Gilgamesh rises and invites Ushanabi to continue with him into the city. When they get there, he says, Ushanabi, go up on the wall of Uruk and walk around. Examine its foundation. Inspect its brickwork thoroughly. Is not the inner wall made of kiln-fired brick? And for those with great memories, remember, these are the first words of the epic, repeated again at the end. Is not the inner wall made of kiln-fired brick? Did not the seven sages themselves lay out its plans? One-third city, one-third palm gardens, one-third lowlands, and the open area of the Ishtar temple. The wall of Uruk encloses. Examine the story of Gilgamesh, who is two-thirds god and one-third human when this great tale began, embracing mighty weapons and even meteors, quote, like a lover, superhuman. Now at the end, he seems altogether human. Up on the wall where the story began, at last, he's part of things, of that great project that we call humanity, which he now embraces If not like a lover, then at least like a true member. He's lost so much on his journey, but what he's gained, he could have found no other way. He has found his way home at last. May we find ours as well. Amen.